Welcome to the Beekeeper's Corner Podcast.
July 6, 2014, episode number 59, Report Card. Welcome everyone to another edition of the Beekeeper's Corner Podcast. It's time to monitor the mite loads. Treat bees for varroa, if that's your thing. It's mid-year, and I'm in a reflective kind of mood, so we'll call this episode Report Card. It's a good time to look at where we've been this year and where we're heading. I had content prepped for a quick turnaround in the last 2 weeks, but came down with the flu, and then mostly recovered, hustled off to Washington, D.C. for work. So many things have happened over the past few days and weeks, culminating in going to Pocono Raceway today to take in an IndyCar race. This is what I, Kevin England, sound like, a little bit worn out, but I am jonesing to get to an episode and get it out there because there's so much to say. So first, what's first? Congrats to Juan Pablo Montoya for the win today. We were rooting for him and he didn't disappoint. No, that's not it. I'm off tangent already. Let's go with our lead-in. The Local Hive Report. The Local Hive Report, 11 hives on the property, and they're all in functional shape. We've added 4 hives since our last episode, and you'll hear about at least one of them in a few minutes. But I recently had a chance to obtain some high-quality Carniolian queens. I did some splits from my yards and made 3 hives for my pretty ladies. 2 of those queens settled in and got to work, but one seemed off to a kind of slow start. I checked in on her, and she had 1 frame of brood set up with eggs and larvae, so I figured she was just a slow starter and good to go, going at her own pace, so to speak. The next time I peeked in on her, nope. When I checked that particular hive, she was gone, and there were supersedure cells off the face of the comb where she laid her eggs. My guess is the nurse bees must have found something they didn't like and dispatched her. It was odd, but I suppose the replacement queen will be from her lineage, and what other choice do I have, frankly? So I had 7 hives on the property last time. With those 3, it makes 10, but wait, there's one more. I had a half day off on Friday, June 20th, the day before I came down with the flu, and I made arrangements with Bob Claus to go check out a honeybee swarm reported from a church in Lambertville, New Jersey. We had information that it was high up, but we would be able to access it from scaffolding set up around the building. They're currently replacing the roof, and they're going to stucco the outside of the church, and they encountered bees in one of the soffits for the steeple tower. Bob and I prepped for a swarm, but considered that we might have to do some of a cutout. A cutout it was, and we ended up prying up the copper flashing and separating the roof to remove what was a far bigger hive than we anticipated. As is my nature, I shot video of the operation, and I'll save some of the details for the commentary I have in segment number 1, but just encourage you to go watch and see what took place. Recently, someone asked me about the top bar hive that I built last year and hadn't deployed, and what my plans were for 2014. These bees and some of their comb went in there, and I'm really excited to get that hive pressed into service. Now, I'd like to tell you there's a great and wonderful happy ending here, but I'm sorry to say I didn't seem to get the queen, or she was damaged in the capture somehow. I really don't know what happened to her. I can report that the bees did make a queen cell of some of the eggs and brood that I gave them from their comb as a fallback. And with this, the hive and the other hive where the Carniolian queen didn't settle in, both of these hives had their queens emerge from the cells this past week, and presumably they are getting out mated this weekend. For me, they are both watches, but I have a positive thought that while I'm behind with these hives, it's awful late to getting started. We'll work diligently to get them to pull through. Most of all, I would consider this church hive the closest thing to feral stock. Up high, no interference from man, and they had smaller bees by the look of it. I really, 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 really wanted this hive to make it. So I have my fingers crossed in the biggest way. So the day after I came down with the flu, and then I went away for work, mostly recovered, as I mentioned. I still had a fever when I drove down there. I went to Washington, D.C. for a conference. And the last 2 weeks have been a combination of life events and commitments other than beekeeping, but on every occasion I put in hours building equipment, frames, loading in foundation, and I even built two new hive stands, which I'll talk about later in the episode. I think Sharon and I, in combination, and she helped me with this, have loaded something like 120 frames in the last 2 weeks with foundation. It's been a yeoman's task. So about the other 10 hives, every one of them has at least two boxes on them, and they are growing nicely. Now, one of those, disclosure, is a nuke, but it's two stories, and I think I'm going to let it go into winter this way, but more on that in a future episode. I have a quandary, which I'm wrestling with, and it concerns feeding. If you're a listener on the podcast, then you know by now that I'm not a fan of this practice, but that's where the conventional part comes in. These are all fundamentally new hives, and I want them to overwinter. In my region, July and August are usually a dearth. They are dearth months, is the best way to say it. No nectar comes in. There's very little water in the plants. Even the streams dry up. And hives tend to scale back and wait entrenched for the fall. For me, I want three deeps, and I won't get there by waiting for the fall, so I'm going to have to look at some of these smaller hives and feed them something. I don't see this as objectionable, as I'll work on getting the 11 to overwinter, and in 2015 I'll have what I haven't had in the last 2 years, some boxes that I won't have to split to keep the yard going. What I really want is bees to come out of winter full strength, and some of them that I can leave to their own devices. And some of them I'll make splits and make more bees. So it's a little disjointed local hive report, but there's a lot going on. And like I mentioned in the last episode, I consider every day priceless and have been executing the 2014 plan like a fiend. It's been fun and exhausting all at once. And I'll talk about 2015 plans later, but I have to keep my foot on the gas to get where I'm going next year. It's all good. Now, if I only had time to weed whack and mow the bee yard, the darn grass is growing like crazy this year. That's what's going on in the Brand Hollow apiary. For segment number one, I want to go a little more into detail about the church cutout. I thought in this segment I'd talk about the details and observations, but I won't belabor the point. This will be more like an after-action report, or if you like it better, a lessons learned. First and foremost, I didn't feel well that day, but I went anyway and had no idea what we were getting into. I stood 56 foot in the air, feet, on scaffold for 4.5 hours straight. How about that? It was a long work. It was a lot of work. And while it went like clockwork, it wore me out. Little did I know I was coming down with the flu. Probably a bad idea. In retrospect, it was probably a two-person job, and it could have been done differently. I can't say that I had trouble with how high up I was, up on the scaffold, but we made the right move by asking him to set up an additional frame so I would be surrounded. When we got there, they had the scaffold built up to where the bees were, but they didn't have a frame around that platform, and I didn't really feel comfortable standing there without a frame to fall against should I trip or do something. I would have went right over the edge. Now, I come from a family that has bricklaying as a staple occupation, and I spent many years in my youth climbing up and down scaffolding. I will admit the first climb to the top was a bit shaky, but after that it was like riding a bike and the jitters evaporated. I recognized early that the job was a big one and made the right calls for the tools and containers. We had the right plan, and I got the space open and reasonable exposure to the comb. I wore my Weave bee suit. If you don't have one of these, you have to get one. And have to say it was spectacular. The airflow allowed me to keep on working comfortably the whole time on a somewhat warm day. And I know Danny was in one of the other bee suits that we have, a traditional cloth one, and he was hot most of the time. The bad news is I took 21 stings on my fingers and hands, both hands. Reaching in and pinching comb to pull and detach it was a significant chore. And I did have nitrile gloves on, but Bob made a good suggestion. In retrospect, you should have some really heavy leather gloves. And you're going to have to discard them afterwards because I was covered with honey up to my elbows. Pinching comb resulted in stinging bees and it couldn't be avoided. I would take the hive tool and cut the top off where it was connected and hanging, but it was really old and it was attached very well, and a lot of times you could try and reach in and scrape as much as you could. One of the other after-action reports is we probably could have used a long knife, would have been a better tool than the hive tool that I used. But you really had no choice but to reach in there, grab hold of the comb from both sides, pinch it, and pull as hard as you could to get the comb out of there. And a lot of times I pinched bees and I got stung. The one funny thing about it is my arms up to my elbows and my face from leading into the hive were all covered with honey, and my suit was really, really dirty. I had to literally take it and put it in a bathtub and let it soak and then scrub it down to get all the honey in. It's still somewhat stained from the propolis, but it actually came out really clean, which you should be cleaning your equipment occasionally anyway, if you haven't caught that in one of our past episodes, but it did a number on my suit, but I got it mostly clean, so don't wear your good equipment if you're going to do that. We used Bob's vacuum, and it was spectacular. I guess the one problem in retrospect was how much honey I sucked up. And when you're working in that chamber, which wasn't open completely, it was difficult to tell what you were sucking up. You were just basically going after bees, but you were getting everything. So the honey that got sucked in coated all the bees in the bucket, and many of them were smothered and suffocated. I don't think the vacuum itself killed any of the bees from the suction part. We've used it before, it didn't have problems. But for sure the honey did. In retrospect, Bob and I talked about it. You know, these bees are in the summertime, a couple weeks only, and there was a lot of comb with a lot of brood, capped brood and whatever. So we were able to reestablish a workforce from that. But we did, unfortunately, damage a lot of bees. When I do this again, I will do a better job at saving the comb. And we'll prep it in some way. We were ill-prepared, and we took a big bucket or a container, like a plastic tote, and we were putting the comb in it, and I was putting it face down, and I stacked it up that way. I really should have stood it on end and stacked it like books, but I didn't do it that way. And much of it was damaged beyond repair. And I think, you know, there was a huge amount of comb. There probably had to be 60 to 80 combs in that chamber, the biggest chamber that I had. And Bob and I talked about we would probably bring nukes and try and salvage that. I can't imagine the number of hives we could have made from just that. But again, we had no idea what we were getting into going in there. At least the good news was I was able to salvage some of the brood comb, and it was successful in making a new queen. So observations, let me talk about this, what I saw while my head was in there. The comb was old, old, old. Some of it had been in there for years, for sure. So don't ask me how I know this, but it was obvious. You could see over the years how they progressed from the point of the soffit at the top and how they built it down to the bottom of the chamber available to them. Every single inch of space that they had available to them, they had built a comb matrix in. It was spectacular to see, and as I said earlier, I highly encourage you to check out the video. You go to youtube.com/NWNJBA and look for the Church Swarm video. When we were looking at the bees that we were pulling out, they looked really small to us. Bob Kloss and Danny and I did the job, and we noticed that right away. I'm not sure if it's a byproduct of the old comb and the cells being used over and over again, making them smaller, or if there's truth that unmanaged bees in the wild are smaller in nature. I could tell you that I literally took out a ruler and measured comb from the church that we retrieved and comb from my yard, and surprisingly, it was exactly the same cell size. I have to say we were really surprised about that, but the measurements didn't lie. Now, I measured something that was like middle-aged comb. I didn't measure the really old stuff, but I was looking to see whether the brood came. I measured 10 cells across on both of them, and it was exactly the same distance. So in the end, it was a fun experience and one for the diary. I have watched other videos on cutouts that people have done on YouTube, and I've seen demos of the topic at bee meetings, but this was our first personal foray. What a way to get indoctrinated. And in the end, everyone was happy. The workers were pleased that they didn't have to deal with the bees. When we were talking to the guys setting the scaffold up, one of them got up there bravely and set the frames up for me, but they really didn't want to go near it. They were very happy when we pulled out a big hunk of honeycomb and handed it to them, though. They thought that was the coolest thing in the world. The church was happy we saved the bees, and quite frankly, we were too. It's such an important stock that we really wanted to make sure that it got preserved. And I have bees for my top bar. And did I say the video was cool? Yeah, the video is cool. So some of the side jaunts in beekeeping are just as fun as the conventional path. If we had to do it all over again, we would do it differently, but for the first time in a couple novices, I think we did okay, and it was a lot of fun, and I look forward to the next one. For segment number two in this episode, I want to talk about treatments. Treatments for Varroa are part of a beekeeper's workload if mite thresholds get too high. In New Jersey, the state apiarist reports that beekeepers who treated lost anywhere from 10 to 30% of their bees. Don't treat, it will be higher, even up to 60% losses. The state apiarist is Tim Schuler, and he recently spoke on the topic of treatments to our Beekeepers Association, and I thought it would be a good time to do a few segments on Varroa treatment options. It is that time of year. For this segment, I'm going to do a short primer and then talk about Mudaway Quick Strips as a treatment option. In near episodes, I'll come back with Apigard, Apivar, and some other options that you have at your disposal. First things first, as we've mentioned in the past, Varroa are in the hive all the time, but July and August in New Jersey are the times to treat for bees. The Varroa overwinter in the hive, and then they grow when the population grows in the spring and into early summer, which is where we sit now. The concern is when Varroa is in numbers large enough to impact the health of the bees, that's a bad timing thing because the bees are about to contract when the nectar flow ends from the spring. The mites will double their population every 22 days, and one mite can become 15 mites in 4 months with just one female present. If you think about the way that that one mite will grow into multiple mites, which will then grow into even multiple of multiple mites, it is highly likely that the longer you have mites in your hives, the larger the threshold is going to get. So Varroa not only compromise the bees by making a wound on them, they vector viruses and quickly can make a healthy colony sick, especially when they're growing in numbers. Treatments for Varroa require vigilance, and some beekeepers are subscribing to the notion to hit them early and hit them often. So when you want to talk about measuring mite loads, you have to take samples of them, and you take the sample from the brood area. The brood area is where you're going to find the mites. They hang out with the brood. They don't hang out in the honey boxes. They don't hang out at the entrance. Go in, grab a brood frame, knock it down onto some sort of container, and then using a scooper, get a half cup of bees, which is a 300 count. Check them with an alcohol wash, and you want no more than one mite per 100 bees, or 3.5 cups sampled. If you have more than 3, you're above the threshold. So there's been a lot of speculation about the number of mites and how many per 300 count of bees, which is a half a cup of bees, remember? The experts are starting to indicate that you should be treating to knock the mites down or risk unhealthy colonies when you get 3 mites per 300 or 1 per 100, however you want to look at that. So one tool in your arsenal, let's go over Mite Away Quick Strips. It's a new product, relatively, in the beekeeper's toolbox. They're a formic acid product in a pad that you apply to the brood nest. You place it in your colony for 7 days. The way that it works is it sterilizes the male mite so they cannot reproduce with the females in the hive. You're going to take 2 pads, which come in 1 pack, and you're going to place them to treat in between the boxes on the brood chamber. I'll go over the literal procedure in a moment. But first thing is a couple discussion points. Safety first. If you look at the material safety data sheet, it recommends that if working indoors, wear a respirator with an organic vapor removing cartridge with a pre-filter approved for pesticides. There's a potential chronic health effect if you have repeated or prolonged contact with this product and or its vapor, and it may produce eye irritation, injury to the cornea, nasal, respiratory tract irritation, and or severe skin irritation. So it's an acid. You don't want to get it on your hands, your eyes, your fumes, any of that. You don't want to be dealing with it. Don't touch it with your bare skin. Make sure you wear gloves that are rated for formic acid. The best idea is to go to the website of the provider and read all the instructions and follow them. So if memory serves me right, originally it said you were supposed to wear a respirator with this all the time, but I think I've seen that's kind of backed away. But again, go read the instructions and do what you feel is correct. If you're the type of person that's working in a commercial operation and you're doing nothing but going out in 100 hives and putting this stuff on, you better be very diligent about how you're handling it. So let's switch gears and go into the usage. It can be applied between 50 degrees and 85 degrees Fahrenheit. They recommended that the day 2 through day 7 temperatures stay between 50 and 92 degrees. So the difference between that is it can be applied when it's up to 85 degrees. On that first day, it's really going to gas out. And then later it won't gas out as much, so you can go with a little bit higher of a temperature. And if you're not using this product, make sure you store it in a place where it's not going to gas out. You have to keep it below 77 degrees Fahrenheit. Good idea to store this in a cool, dark place. It's supposed to be for 2 deeps, and I'd be leery about using it any other way, although there is a provision for using it on 1 box. You're going to close the bottom of the hive. The product works by fumigation, and it's heavier than air. If you leave the bottom open, it will drop out of the bottom of the hive and not be an effective treatment. So one tip that I've heard with these in usage is store them in the freezer, which makes them easier to peel. And Tim talked about them, and he indicated that practices of using it higher than 80 degrees Fahrenheit don't necessarily work out really well. It vaporizes too quickly, and it really does a number on the bees. I think with all these fuming products, 80 degrees, 82 degrees is about as high as you want to go. I would not put them on when it's 90 degrees out. I know some of the products, not just Mite Away Quick Strips, say that you can apply them up to 90-something degrees. I don't buy that. Everybody that I've ever heard put these products on, when it's hotter than 80, 85 degrees, it just nukes the hives. So my recommendation for me personally, in my personal experience, is don't do that. It's a good idea to put these on when twilight is approaching. It tends to be a little cooler at night, and all the bees are there. And Mite Away Quick Strips is a good early of season product. It's the only one that you can use with honey boxes on. So some of you who are getting into July here and haven't taken your honey off, you can use this product with honey. I think this is probably one of the only ones that you could use with honey. The U.S. product only has a one-year shelf life, and they instruct you not to use it after its expiration. So don't stock up on this when you go to buy your product. The product site indicates that you should be going into a dormant hive for 3 days prior. Let me say that a different way. Don't do anything with your hive. That's what they mean by that. So leave your hives dormant. Don't be opening it. Don't be disturbing it. Don't be doing anything 3 days prior. They noted that colonies that are worked on prior to treatment demonstrated some absconding behavior. So there's a lot of onus in not disregarding that direction. So if you're going to apply Mite Away Quick Strips, this is the procedure. Put on the right protective gear. Separate the top of the brood chamber box from the bottom. Cut the package on the line indicated on the plastic sleeve that holds the strips. Separate the strips and place them on the top bars perpendicular to how the frames run. The product instruction site indicates to leave the plastic wrap on the strips as the paper acts as a wick and controls the speed of the release. It slows it down, and I think that's really important. The product website also indicates to provide an extra super or box above the brood chamber to allow the bees a place to move up and expand. In other words, what they mean is to go get away from it. It doesn't change the effectiveness of the product application when you add more space inside the hive. So sometimes you get in a situation where you have the entrances reduced. You're trying to prevent robbing and so on. If that's the case, on the product website, what it indicates is you have the bottom box sitting on the bottom board with your entrance reducer on. And the second box, you've applied the application between them. Pull that second box back a little bit. You're going to leave a gap in the front of the hive about a half inch, and that's going to allow that extra fumigation to escape. It's not going to render the treatment ineffective, but it's going to make sure that you don't gas the bees. There has to be some ventilation for this stuff to work. So go in, make your application, put your product in following the instructions, and then use water and wash your hive tools, your gloves, and anything else that comes in to contact with the product. So we said earlier you could use this for one deep brood chamber. I'm not sure that the instructions that I saw were very clear on this, but the video from the website showed the same treatment, two pads over a single deep brood chamber. There's a diagram on the website, however, that shows one pad on a single deep. The interesting part about the diagram is one pad is placed dead center over the frames. And again, I think if you have just one deep, I'm going to put one pad on there. I'm not going to put two. I've heard many good comments about this product, but also a number of comments about how strong it is. I'd be leery of using two on a single deep. And for that matter, two deeps, they're encouraging you to add a super to the top of the brood chamber. And that additional box is so the bees have a place to go, but I think it also does make it a little less effective, less potent, and doesn't do such a number on the bees and the brood. And the other problem that you also have in here is if it fumigates too fast, too quickly, it could mask the scent of the queen and cause issues there. So I'm saying one pad for a single deep. Doesn't that make sense? So let me share some final thoughts here about Mite Away Quick Strips. And I've heard so much good about them. Haven't used them yet personally, because I haven't been treating, but this might be a year for it. So on the website, it said knockdown versus knockout. It indicates that you could use a half dose application. You could treat with one strip the first week and then use a second strip in 2 months' time. And it suggests that by reducing your treatment in half, you will experience fewer side effects. That's very interesting. I'm kind of surprised they even offer that as an option, but some beekeepers have experienced a lot of dead bees at the entrance and so on when this product first came out. I think a lot of them used it when it was too hot. And this is interesting that they would allow you to do a partial treatment. That usually flies in the convention of everybody wants to kill every mite they can. And if you do partial treatments, you could potentially be breeding stronger mites. But in this case, I don't think that's true. And they offer a half-dose application methodology. So this is probably the most important final thought of them all, is you need to follow up. Treatments are not worth doing if you're not going to follow up and checking your thresholds to see how effective they are. And the New Jersey State Apiarist was very clear in his talk to us that treating once a year is not effective enough anymore. Those who are doing it are playing roulette. What you really need to do, and Randy Oliver told us the same thing, Randy went as far as saying he watches the thresholds consistently, and he has different treatment options that he uses during times of year, and the state apiarist echoed those same thoughts. And you need to just keep monitoring your threshold, and when they're up, you need to apply the product that makes sense for the time of year you're in. And to that end, switching the products, a final thought, switch it up. Not every product kills a certain kind of mite. And some of these products are not 100% kill, they're 60% kill. And if you keep using the same product over and over again, the ones that don't die from this product are breeding. So you use a different product on them, and you kill them, and you clear that out so that we're not breeding super mites. One last thought about using Mite Away Quick Strips for those of you who are running nukes. The product was designed for full-size colonies. You really have to use caution if you're going to consider using these on nukes, and you'd probably be better off using a different product. This stuff is really strong, and it's not made for that size chamber. In fact, I think I recall the website saying don't use them on nukes. So I hope you found that helpful, and if you're in the interest of looking at Mite Away Quick Strips, it's made by NOD, N-O-D is the name of the manufacturer, and you can go look on their website. I recommend you pull down the application instructions and the MSDS, the Material Safety Data Sheet, and read those thoroughly. And I really would say this as a public service announcement, no matter what product you use, always, always, always read the labels before you put it on. And if one is good, two is not better. Follow the directions. So as I mentioned at the opening of this segment, we'll be back next episode for a few other options for treatment. And in the meantime, I mentioned that Tim spoke recently at one of our meetings. We shot video, of course, and if you want to hear what Tim said about treatments, including Mite Away Quick Strips, you can head over to our YouTube page, youtube.com/NWNJBA. You won't be disappointed, and he also talks about winter death loss and other personal experiences, mite counts, things that he's doing. So it's really worth the watch, that video. And on the subject of Tim Schuler, been having a lot of conversations with him recently, and I'm pretty positive that we're going to have Tim on the podcast pretty soon, maybe even to pick up this topic in our next episode. And I'm really looking forward to getting Tim to come on the show and share some dialogue with him, have many questions, and we'll just have to see if the logistics work out for our next episode. But we're probably even going to do some sort of video cast on that, because they recently obtained a high quality video camera, so we can do that. So I'm looking forward to putting those arrangements together, and we'll see how that goes. For segment number three, I want to talk about a mid-year update and a report card on objectives. First part of this is more hives. I had some objectives for 2014, and most of it was to get my bee yard up and running and put in place a plan that not only brought bees back, but provided a long-term sustainability for my yard. The last few years have been experimental, and lately I've seen the errors in my ways. You really can experiment and learn with only a few hives. I so want to go treatment-free. No feed. No feeding the bees. But over the past few years, it hasn't worked out for me, and I'm going back to a more conventional posture for a period of time. As a podcaster on beekeeping, I get a lot of advice and commentary. I'm sure you know the old adage, ask a beekeeper a question and you'll get 10 different answers. Well, I know a lot of folks, and suffice it to say, I get a lot of advice. I appreciate that and factor whatever anybody says into just about everything that comes to my way, but at some point, I personally have to make a decision and execute. My plan this year? Bees. Preferably, I was going to get bees from swarms, feral bees, or overwintered stock. Well, 11 hives in the yard, and that's where I sit. 4 overwintered bees from New Jersey survivor stock, 4 hives. 3 of them came from swarms, from survivor stock. 3 splits from those 7 hives, and I added Carniolian queens, high-quality ones from a well-known queen producer, and 1 hive that came from an established hive in a church that was unmolested by mankind. This is all good, so now I have a good start, and all I have to do is not screw it up. Yeah, easier said than done. As I said in the local hive report, my hope is to build everything into 2, or preferably 3 deeps worth of bees. Some are well on their way, and others are a bit behind. For the ones that are behind, they are not big enough given the length of the nectar flow in the region. And the nectar flow is about to come to a crashing end. I'm feeling just a little bit behind in their size, but I really didn't have much control of the situation given the start times of these hives, so I'll do what I can to make these hives viable for winter and pray to the bee gods for a good nectar flow in the fall. So I kind of alluded to objective number 2, which was to capture some swarms. I really thought what I was going to do was put boxes out in the world, but the fact of the matter is I'm not on any swarm reports, but I got a number of calls for swarms and was able to pick up 3. And one of them was a pole capture, meaning a big extended device that captured one 20-something feet in the air, which was really cool. So objective met there for swarm captures. Objective number 3 is feral bees. I wanted ferals in the box. And I bagged what I'll loosely call a feral hive from the church, but that's not really what I'm after. I want them coming out of trees from some forest. In segment 3, I'll talk about the gauntlet for ferals for 2015, so I'll stop here on this objective. But at least I have the church one, which was, as I said, unmolested by mankind. Objective number 4 was more than 4 hives, and with 11 hives, I'm in a good place. I want a quantity of bees. I want all new queens, so I'm real happy about the way this is going. I will have good, vibrant hives in the spring of 2015, and will not be, as I've been in the last couple years, in a poverty of bees. And the last one that I'll call out is differing form factors of hives in my yard to get experience about these. I have a box with all mediums. I have my polystyrene styrofoam hive deployed. I have my Langstroth cedar hive deployed. I have an 8-frame hive deployed. I have the top bar out there. And the good news is I've been using hive tracking and I have inspections all registered in hive tracks. And the hive inspections are being completed as they should be. I guess I could talk about one bad objective that I have not met, which is being intrusive to my bees. I like Jason's, if you've listened to the podcast, Jason Bruns, we interviewed him once, concept of let him be, But I think one of the things I have to do at this point is watch the bees so I know when I could put new boxes on and understand if there's queens in there or not. And one of the things I want to do this year, because I've never done it before, is mark all my queens. And that goes to a 2015 objective, which I'll get to in a second. So I think I've been a little too intrusive, but that's about to come to an end. Now that they're all too deep, so I don't need to be going in them. I know they all have operational queens. And I was really just watching to make sure I knew when to put the boxes on. So from a 2014 standpoint, many of the objectives have been met. I'd give myself a C plus or a B minus on the report card. I'd really like to have my Bs a little bit stronger, but so wouldn't everybody else. So that's where we stand. I think the report card's okay. So where there is a yin, there is a yang, and in segment number 4, I want to talk about the 2015 objectives, and it is not too early. On my list, feral hives, natural comb, and queen management. I guess I'll start with feral hives, and I'm going to build this into the 2015 plan. One of the things that I want to do is build a number of boxes. I took the extra boxes that I had and I deployed them out around the community, but then as I got swarms and splits and whatever, I pulled them all back in. But in a haphazard way, that I know that I'm not really going to get good ferals from the ones that I put in place. I've mentioned Jason Bruns just a moment ago. Jason and I have been having an exchange. I've been sharing it with Bob Kloss. He's involved in it, and Bob and I have been talking about an active plan to build a bunch of swarm traps, put them up high, face them in the right direction, set them the right size, bait them properly, and put them in places where there aren't a lot of beekeepers around, and see if we can catch some true feral bees. Now the million-dollar question is, and I think I know the answer, do we have any feral bees in New Jersey? The answer is of course. The question is, do we have them in our area? The county which I live in is pretty populated. There's a lot of farms, but not a lot of wooded area. I'm sure if you go up north to, say, Sussex County, and across the top edge of the western side of the state, coming down through the Delaware Water Gap, you could find a lot of areas where there's probably feral bees. And I have to believe that maybe there's some stand of woods near where I live that I can go talk to someone and put some feral swarm traps up and see what we can catch. I was looking at something in Bee Culture magazine recently that had this pole, which was a deployment device that you use that cantilevers the hive up so you could fasten it to a tree. And I think the fall workshop is to build one of these along with some of the boxes. Jason was kind enough to send me some plans. We even joked about driving out to see Jason and going through his hives and looking at his feral areas and all that other stuff. And who knows, we might be in for a road trip. So Jason, we'll see how the year progresses and see whether the boss allows that. It was a joke, but kind of like I'm serious about a road trip. We'll see. So 2015 objective, feral hives. 2015 objective, natural comb. And what I mean by that is something Bob's doing routinely. Bob and I are like superheroes. We were trying to joke as to who was Superman and who was Batman and whatever. We're yin and yang of the Wonder Twins or something. It's funny, when I listen to podcasting, a lot of times you find people who do podcasting and they always have somebody who is their collaborator in these things, and the dialogue between the two always makes the show stronger. And in this case, Bob's been joining me on the podcast semi-regularly, and I'm sure he'll be here more and more often, and we talk again almost weekly about these things. So where we're talking about natural comb, and Bob's been doing a lot of this, he just goes foundationless. I just built a lot of frames with foundation. Again, I'm trying to go the conventional route and get a lot of hives. But next year my plan is, when the spring comes and the bees are in a comb-building kind of mind, I'm going to start running strips across, and I want them to build their own comb. And I'm really interested in a couple changes that I see in some of these natural hives. One of them is they build natural cell with drone brood on the bottom. And the natural cell, from what I see, over time develops to be smaller than normal. I want to see if that phenomena plays out. But in order to do that, another objective that needs to be met is you just got to have a lot of hives so you can do experiments. I have all my hives in my yard, and I think my yard is less than optimal because it doesn't get that early morning sun, but I live in the woods and I really don't have a chance. At some point about 10, 11 o'clock, the sun meanders over the trees to the cornfield next to me, and the bees get full sun, but by that time, most of the plants are probably not as viable as they were. So one of the 2015 objectives is to seriously consider finding an outyard somewhere. And I think what I'll do is keep some of those boutique or unusual hives in my property to continue to learn with them, but put a contingent of Langstroth hives somewhere out in a place that gets full sun and is a better foraging area, an outyard, but not too far away. And there, I could start doing more comb building and natural comb and some of the other stuff that I want to do. And last but not least, I'm sure as a 2015 objective, queen management is on the parade. So I've been saying it over and over, and the more I say it, the more I convince myself that you need to replace your queens. And I mean that in a nice way. First year, they're fantastic. Overwinter, second year, they're fantastic. Third year, I have yet to tell anybody or hear anybody tell me that they're fantastic. So one of the reasons I painted my queens green, which signifies a 2014 year ending in 4, is because a couple years from now, I'm going to replace them. I want to get on a queen management. And a close tie to that objective is to have a queen bank and raise quality queens right here in my own yard to replace my queens and keep them fresh and vigorous. So here's a $1 million question. What are your 2015 objectives? And many of you are in so many different places than where I stand. Some of you, this is your first year. Some of you don't have bees. Some of you have more hives than I do. So it would be interesting to start talking about 2015 ideas. And what we'll do is on Facebook.com/beekeeperscorner, I'll post an item to ask you, what are your 2015 objectives? And come on out and participate in the conversation and see what others have to say. So get your 2015 objectives set up. And I guess the funny thing is, if you think about some of you who listen internationally are in the middle of winter, you really need to get on the ball because some of you need to build equipment right now in anticipation of spring, which is right around the corner. And good for you. It's always great that some beekeeper somewhere is dreaming about the next spring to come. For segment number 5, I want to talk about queen identification and a question that came in from a beekeeper in our association. I'm glad to get to a topic that has nothing to do with our apiary. I don't usually talk that much about all of this stuff, but that's the way this episode is going, so I'm glad to get off topic and go to something different. I had a question from Judy Link about queens, and she has a bunch of them that are mostly orangey in her terminology, and more specifically, she's guessing they're Italians, but recently they inspected a nuc with a new queen, and she's dark brown to black. The question was, is it a Russian bee? So while that's an interesting notion, let's talk about queen colors, and I don't think it's a Russian bee. But I could be wrong. And here's the answer, straight out. You can't tell what kind of bee it is by the way the queen looks. There are generalizations about what the bees look like, but queens come in so many different colors because the way they mate, you really can't tell. I've seen Italian bees build straight-up Italian bees with a darker-looking queen, who I'm positive was an Italian bee. But that being said, let me talk about at least the three or four most popular ones. And Italian bees, and I'm reading from the College of Agricultural and Environmental Sciences website, which I'll provide a link. Apis mellifera linguistica. Originally from Italy, Italian bees are the most popular honey bees. They're yellow in color, relatively gentle, overwinter well, and build up quickly in the spring. They're easily provoked to rob weaker neighboring colonies and sometimes exhaust honey stores rapidly in winter. And the picture of the queen there is mostly yellow and gold with brown bands. Almost copper brown or how would you say that? I know the color that we're looking for is something along the lines of a gold or a tan. And occasionally they have some dark markings on them also. Key is they're more yellow in color. Another popular bee that's sold in this area is Carniolian bees, Apis mellifera carnica. They originated in the Australian Alps, northern Yugoslavia, and the Danube Valley. They're gray and brown in color, extremely gentle, can serve winter food stores well, and build up quickly in the spring. They construct new combs slowly and swarm frequently. So these bees tend to be more towards the description of what they had. They're almost dark brown, gray, sometimes black in color. I have one in my hive that she's completely black from head to toe with maybe one light gray band, and I know that's a Carniolian bee because I just purchased her from the queen breeder who builds Carniolian bees. I'm highly thinking that what she had in her hive was one of those. There is a possibility that it has a little bit of German black bee in it, for that is the first bee, if I'm correct, that was brought over to the United States. They're originally from Northern Europe. The German black bee was the first honeybee brought to the New World. There it vindicates me. They are brown, black in color, and overwinter well. German black bees are nervous, aggressive, and build up slowly in spring. They were a really popular bee, but they didn't do as much foraging, if I remember correctly. They didn't bring back as much bounty for the beekeeper. And the other thing is they were well into building propolis and mucking up the hive. So people got away from German black bees, but there's so much of its stock still in the gene pool out there that a lot of bees have German black bee traits. So another bee that is around now is the Russian honeybee, Apis mellifera caucasia. They came from the Primorsky region of Russia. They were used for breeding mite resistance, and that's one of the lures of bringing them here to the United States. There are Russian breeders, and you can actually buy these bees. In the beginning, it was just a small group, but now they're starting to be distributed. They're said to be a bit more defensive. And from Michael Bush's website, he has a little blurb on them that says they tend to headbutt a lot, but not stinging, and they're very watchful guards, but not runny, meaning they run around on the comb and so on. They tend to be more swarmy, from what I've heard. And swarmy is a term that's used quite a bit with bees, depending on the race that you have. Some are more swarmy than others. Russian bees are said to be more frugal, like Carniolian bees versus the Italian bees. And one of the lures, of course, for Russian and Carniolian bees is they come from colder climates. They tend to adapt to the northern U.S., which is why they're being brought over to augment the Italian bees, which come from the region down by the boot, which is pretty tropical. That's a public service message. If you've heard it, update your virus definitions on your machine. I used Avast, which is a free tool, and they make a very good product. Back to our regularly scheduled program. Another bee that I hear being used in circles is Buckfast bees. They were developed by Brother Adam of Buckfast Abbey, hence the name. They're supposed to be gentle. They build up rapidly in the spring, and they do really well with bringing in a lot of resources. For you, the beekeeper, that means a lot of honey, and then they fall back in population. They're supposed to be like Italians in robbing, though. And I don't know what they look like from a color standpoint. I couldn't find any data on that. So I'll give you two websites to go look at in the show notes. And of course, Michael Bush is just a plethora of information. Bushfarms.com is his website. If you want to look up information, it's always there. This is particular bushfarms.com/beeraces.htm. The other site that I was referring to is the University of Georgia College of Agricultural and Environmental Sciences. It's www.ent.uga.edu, and you could do a search there and look for bee races. I'll put these two in the show notes so you can take a look at the pictures there too. So we've come to the end of our features for this episode. Now we're going to roll into the back of the book. This is the roundtable section where we just run through a couple of topics. And the first one that I wanted to put in is about queen introduction and a personal experience. I installed these three queens from queen cages. And I had this theory that, you know, most times when you install queens, they come with a package. You put the package in, the queen's been with the package. I've never... me personally, first time, installed just a queen into a box that didn't have a queen in it. And of course, that's the trick of it. You want to make sure whatever hive you're inserting them into does not have a queen. I pulled four frames out in a typical nuke fashion to create a new hive, meaning a frame of eggs and brood, no queen, make sure the queen's not on any of those. A frame of pollen, a frame of capped honey, and a frame of pollen and honey, and put them all together. I took the queen cage that I had, and I removed the cork off the plastic end, and this one had candy in it, and I did it in a brave manner. I'm thinking to myself, maybe this is a dumb situation, but... And if I had to do this, I would have been more patient, but I really wasn't more... exhibiting a lot of patience here. I took the cork out and I just let the queen out. I put her in the box for a little while I did inspections of a hive. I know that some of the bees found her. I looked at the way they behaved on the screen. Nobody was biting at the cage and doing whatever. And then what I did was just took the cork off and I left it pointed down. And I literally let the queen walk out and I closed the hive. In retrospect, it's probably more safe to take a frame and hold the queen on it and release the cork from the candy end and let them discover her and get them going. But I really wanted to get these hives going. Remember, I'm counting the days. So I took my chances with all three hives and just released the queen straight out. I knew that none of these hives had queens in them. I was very careful to inspect the frames that I brought over. Now, one of the things that I did do is I took these frames out of hives and I put them right in a box. And before I let them get this notion that they wanted one, I left them for a little while so that they knew they were queenless. And then two, before I got them too crazy into building new queens, I put the queen cage right in. So it really is a kind of timing thing as you do it. And I played the timing where I left them for about 45 minutes after I pulled the frames out of the mother colonies, and I left them to the side with bees, and they knew there was no queen. That was my rationale. And then I put the queen in there, and I left her sit in there for about 45 minutes so that they could discover her. But one of the things about a queen in a cage, especially one that got shipped to you, she's not been laying. So it is possible that she's not putting a pheromone out. So the quicker she gets in and gets to work, the better off you are, is my opinion. So I popped the cork off, I let her out, and the good news is when I went back a couple days later, she had been accepted, and all three of the queens were laying. Now I said on the outset what happened on the one hive, for whatever reason they replaced her. She was an inseminated queen, so I'm not sure if there was something wrong and she was damaged. I don't know. Can't guess. But the bottom line is they built a supersedure cell and they're replacing the queen. The other two, within 2 weeks, the entire box was full of brood. And they're good to go. And the queens are huge and spectacular looking. Which, if you go back and listen to episodes or three episodes about David Tarpey, the bigger the queen, the better the colony. At least that was what his research showed. So, I guess I'm going to look a little closer next time. I was pretty much in haste for these queen introductions. But I'm going to seek some additional guidance next time. Because when you buy queens, and these are the first bees that I've purchased in years, literally. You want to make sure you don't mess up your investment. Right? The queen could have flew off. They could have killed her immediately. I was a little risque when I did it, but it all turned out okay for me, fortunately. I mean, it was an educated guess, but still, it was pretty risky what I did. For round table number two, I want to talk about handling a drone layer. When we were at the summer meeting for the club, my Beekeepers Association, we went out and worked the hives at somebody's house. They had a number of hives, and one of them we opened up and we found it queenless, and the bees were trying to build something, but they had no fertilized queen, so they had a drone layer. If you've never seen this, it's actually an interesting study in biology of the bees. One of the bees anoints itself as a queen, and it starts laying eggs. But it's not fertilized, so what you see in the middle is this haphazard bullet-shaped capped comb. Every other space, maybe even wider. In the frames that he pulled out, there were two frames. This pseudo-queen laid about 15 drones. And of course, they're not fertilized, so they're all drones. And then the other thing you found in the cells were eggs, but there were three or four of them deposited in the bottom of a cell. So I've encountered this once in the first season of Beekeeper, didn't know what it was absolutely as green as grass, and that hive did not survive for me. But in this case, the state apiarist was there, and he talked to everybody about how to resolve this. And what he did was he took the bees out of the box, and he literally went over to the ground 100 yards away and shook the bees out on the grass. The premise of this is all the nurse bees that have never been out of the hive, including the drone layers, stay in the grass. All the foragers who are wiser get up and fly back to the hive location where they came from. Now what they did was they pulled a frame of brood with open brood and eggs, and along with some resources from another hive, and put it inside that hive. And as the foragers come back, and the bees that they brought out of the other hives, they did harvest some bees, they will make a new queen in there, and the drone layers will stay in the grass. The unfortunate thing is they're going to perish, but you certainly don't want them in there, because if they're releasing some oddball pheromones, they may not raise a new queen. In this case, the hive is queenless, and the presence of eggs and known queen pheromone from the pseudo-queen will invoke a mechanism to build a new queen. And that's exactly what happened here. So, pretty cool little exercise on handling a drone layer if you ever see it. And one of the key things to look for here is bullet comb. So, you're going to see a bunch of different drones built in worker cells, and they're going to have big dome-shaped cappings. They don't belong there. Whenever you see bullet comb, it literally looks like the end cap of a bullet. You know you have a drone layer, and you should be looking for that. So it was neat, and I thank Tim for showing us all how to do that, and I'll be keeping my eyes out. But again, if I meet my 2015 objectives, I'll always have new queens. How about that? Round table number three, new hive stand. You may or may not know that I created a hive stand design that I use in my yard. I like to have each of my hives on its own individual stand that I made it with a PVC pipe, 1-inch PVC pipe, and a bunch of fittings. The current design that I have It could be tedious and requires a little bit of time, probably about an hour and a half to build each one. And they're not very costly, but, you know, they cost money. And I was looking for a different approach. More so because when I saw the one that was presented in the winter meeting from the NJBA, I thought that was pretty neat, the platform that Lincoln's Senate's daughter came up with. Well, lo and behold, I was walking through Home Depot not too long ago and saw something that caught my eye. It was an attractive rack that you could buy to stack stuff on in your garage. It was made with plastic tubes and had five layers on it, and it had what looked to be a pretty rigid top. So the gears got to spin, and I thought about buying one of these. I think they were about $50. They're 3 foot by 18 inches, and there's five racks on them. And I'm thinking to myself, these would make perfect PVC stands and a nice cap and an attractive hive stand. So I bought the pack and I brought it back, and then I used some of the fittings that I had left over from the last hive stand that I built, my original one, and I built a new one, and it came out really nice. So I've since built a second one and got all the measurements and shot a video about how to build one and what type of product it is. I think it's called HDX. You can find them at Lowe's, Home Depot, and other stores, and you can find them on Amazon.com or whatever. So I'll post a video of that, but I'm really happy with the way it came out. The one I built yesterday, I literally put it together in about a half hour, and that includes shooting the video, and I painted it, and it looks really nice. And I need additional hive stands out in my yard. You know, when I grew to 11 hives, I stole literally 2 4x4 posts and concrete blocks from my firewood that I had used and put them out in the yard, and I have 5 hives sitting on rails, and I need to put that back because I need to get my firewood prepped for this year. So the boss is yelling at me about that. So I built a couple hive stands, and I have a couple more to build, and then I can put my firewood back and I'll have to move my hives. But pretty excited about how they look, and I'll see if I could post a picture up on the Facebook page if you want to take a look at it. So we see by the timer we've recently passed over an hour mark in this episode. That's about good enough, I guess. I'll close it down and get prepped for the next one. One of the things I wanted to ask, I know this is pandering, sorry about that, but I'll do it anyway. I'm not above that. It really helps us when you go into iTunes and rate us. The podcast is doing well in there. I have a lot of positive comments, and I like what people share when they're honest. If you come to us via iTunes, please go in there and rate us. That helps when people are searching for us. It helps give us more prominence on that. And that's all I'll say about that. Today is July 6th. A very dear friend from work. It's her birthday, but it happens to be my father's birthday. 79 years young, my father. He looks spectacular. And I say happy birthday to my father. You know, I was sitting at the Pocono Raceway this morning, getting ready to go into the track, and I gave him a call. And God bless him, 79 years old, took his boat out, was fishing in some canal, left at 5 o'clock in the morning, was talking about catching smallmouth bass, and just loves his passion, by himself out in the water on his birthday. He didn't even remember it was his birthday until I told him, and just enjoying it. Folks, you can only aspire to do what you love at 79 years old on a beautiful Florida day. That's all I have to say. So happy birthday, Dad. Looking forward to him coming up the end of this month. We haven't seen him in a while, and yeah, I guess that's it. So I will close this down. Until next time, as always, thanks for coming to see us at the Beekeeper's Corner.